Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast. The top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition to the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 2nd, 2024. So Tommy, what are you going to kick us off with?
So first thing. This week, talking about an article from Proofpoint titled "Malware That Must Not Be Named: Suspected Espionage Campaign Delivers Voldemort." Kind of dug this just from that little nerd plug there. But basically, the overview: last month, Proofpoint researchers identified an unusual campaign that uses a novel attack chain to deliver custom malware. The attack chain used multiple techniques that are well known, as well as some uncommon methods for C2, like the use of Google Sheets, which I found interesting. Proofpoint assessed with moderate confidence that this was coming from an APT actor with a focus on intel gathering and espionage. The malware, named Voldemort by the threat actor themselves, is a custom backdoor written in C. It has capabilities for information gathering and to drop additional payloads like Cobalt Strike and such. The campaign consisted of over 20,000 messages being sent out to 70 different organizations globally, and they were posing primarily as government tax agencies from multiple different countries like US, Japan, Italy, UK, and others. And this campaign targeted a wide variety of industries, so there was no specific industry focus here. The campaign highlights some bullets here. So a phishing message contained malicious URLs, as one does. Once the URL was clicked, a landing page would host another link that would prompt the user to click and view the document. That would drive a first phase of check of the user agent containing Windows or not. So once that URL was clicked, it would check to see if the user agent contained Windows. If it did, it would log info about the user's network and browser, and then drive the attack stages further. If it did not contain Windows, it would simply just log the user's network and browser data, move on. If the user followed through with the additional click of the Window Explorer pop-up that would happen, a LNK file that was masquerading as a PDF would be dropped in the download folder. And when that file was executed, it would download a zip containing a legitimate WebEx EXE called Cisco Collab Host.exe. That was used to sideload DLL called Cisco Spark Launcher.dll. The threat actors would use a growing technique of leveraging Windows saved search file formats and would allow for the threat actor to save a search query as a file on a web dev share. And the malware would then call back to a C2, which is set up in Google Sheets with a authentication client token. Really it's just a fast overview, Scott, but there are a couple things that really stood out to me. I thought was the use of Google Sheets as a C2. I found that interesting. And then also, you know, I've only seen it twice now. I've only read about it twice now, myself personally, but leveraging of the save search file formats. But yeah, you know, ultimately, what were your thoughts on some of this?
So there's a couple of things that were really interesting. I'll touch on the Google Sheet thing first, since you brought it up. One is, since they're using like an API interaction with the Google Sheet in order to do the C2, and then one of the things that was noteworthy was if they went to look, for instance, like cell A1, and there were contents already there, meaning data from another member of the bot put data there, then it does a query going down the list, right? Of that cells, was it like A1, B2, or whatever, I don't know. Trying to think of the order which sheets are read, but either way, it basically goes cell by cell down until it finds an empty cell in order to then check for things or upload things or whatever it's going to do. And that stood out to me because I don't know if I interact with a Google Sheet through a web browser, what kind of activity comes from that, but I can't imagine there's a lot of repeated calls, because it'd be like almost like an open session, right? So I figure like it would make that connection. There's this open session and it may refresh that session after so much time, but because there's that established session, there's not going to be these constant callouts. So from knowing this, an API, you know, typical API interactions with things are a call and response, call and response. And if there is a plethora of people infected by this and they're all performing the same functions, I imagine the one that sheet fills up pretty quick, which is also would increase the number of requests going out. So from like a network or a, you know, network or anything they can see, web activity from like a proxy or something that you might manage, I feel like it'd be very obvious just looking at volume. You know, a lot of times some people look at volume for things that stand out as outliers. And one weird thing is you'd have to understand like what does Google Sheets or Google API look like from that perspective too. But that was an interesting anecdote as far as like maybe this is a way you can kind of pick up on one of the behaviors with just using Google Sheets. And thinking about that, you know, if there are other types of open platforms, if someone want to create a C2 in this manner with other services like this, I imagine it would look very similar. You'd see like an exorbitant amount of requests that you wouldn't expect for, you know, creating a document or a sheet or whatever, however they're storing things. So that stood out. And the other thing was the use of the web dev with the shortcut link. So when it says the shortcut masquerade as a PDF hosted on an external web dev, to make it actually appear it's in the user's local download folder. So this is what's interesting is you can make it look that way. And web dev, the way it works, it's really designed so you can do like remote management of servers and things and to ease that. But it can basically function so that it looks like that document or that share is literally part of your system. So it's a way to kind of establish some trust. But what's interesting is like then they can do back and forth with basically the share created through web dev to move things in and to kind of carry everything over. So I just thought that was an interesting avenue that I haven't seen personally used in that way. So yeah, that was something else that kind of stood out. And if I, you know, WebDAV, I think uses HTTP, but I think you can see that in the header too. So if you're looking for a bunch of like WebDAV connections or what would be interesting for WebDAV for purposes as far as destinations, that's something else you might be able to actually pick up from a network visibility perspective as well. So yeah, those two types of techniques I thought were interesting.
Yeah, it was there was a lot more nugget wise to dig into here. A lot of the article itself, you know, anyone that's really interested in code snippets and the super in depth malware analysis, I think it's worth going in and taking a peek. But yeah, I found it very interesting. What do you got for us, Scott?
See, which one should I start with? I'll start with the malware bytes article that I always find interesting. So this, as far as the topic goes, it says hundreds of online stores hacked and new campaign. And essentially, the technical details really come down to they stumbled across this campaign where there were e-commerce sites, basically, that were getting compromised. And then within there was a script tag. So if you're familiar with HTML, you usually kind of have tags to identify what it is component-wise you're adding. And so there's one that just says script, and then you can put whatever it is, what the script's supposed to be or a location of a script or whatever it is. So basically a simple script tag was added to these compromised sites. There was structure kind of like domain dot, and you either had shop or online, and then like /img/ is like a directory on this external domain. What's interesting, I always find is, for instance, you know, if something was intentional and you saw this on a site when you're looking at the source code of the site, I wouldn't imagine a script should be stored in a location that looks like it's supposed to be storing images. It's always like a kind of part of my litmus test, right? Is like, okay, if does it even make sense? Like if I was an administrator and I actually had a purpose for this, I usually try to do things that make sense because it makes it easier for A to troubleshoot, B to make it easier for other people to like pick up where you left off if they needed to. But so there's that component. But what ends up happening is when you load that site, it basically is a JavaScript blob that comes down that is a skimmer. So on these e-commerce sites where you go in to make these purchases, it's a skimmer. So as you put in your details, live, it's actually pulling those details across and skimming those and stealing those details and sending them off to the attacker-controlled database. And what's also interesting about this is it takes precedence. So there's some of these e-commerce sites that use a third-party way to pay or collect payment information and process it so that they don't really handle it. That, you know, it's usually considered a more secure method but doing that. But since this script actually takes precedence, it doesn't really protect from a skimmer perspective because it's running right there locally in your environment. You know, I thought it was like interesting to me because I am not an HTML web page guy. Like everything I know about HTML has nothing to do with anything I've ever created. It's always about me researching random stuff or seeing things. And it's an area I've always wanted to like increase my knowledge in more. So these things come up. It's always fascinating that one, A, I either understand what's going on and B, you know, I hopefully expand my knowledge a little bit. And something else I wanted to add, and yeah, you're aware of this too, because we've worked together in the past, but I'm a big fan of NoScript. And, you know, if you're not familiar with NoScript as a tool, I like it for two different reasons. One, theoretically, if there's any scripting that runs on a single page, it breaks pages that need scripting. So technically it would prevent those scripts from running. So as a safe measure, this attack likely wouldn't work. Now the payment process might not work either because NoScript might break that part of it too. So that being said, it's kind of a security control that does take some managing, but once you kind of whitelist enough things that you can't, you know, you can trust, it starts to, pages typically work pretty well in general. But the other avenue or other aspect of it is when things do break, I'm able to actually look in the NoScript menu and see what is actually running. And when I talk about not understanding how web pages work, it gives me the ability to say, hey, look, it looks like there's a content delivery network feeding this, and that's being blocked here. There's something ad-driven that's being here. There's some sort of analytics being run from Google or Facebook. I can see those things. Do I care if I want those running? So it kind of gives me an idea of like all the flavors and things that go into a web page outside of just the content itself. And sometimes you can see things that are like, well, this just looks weird. The domain's weird, or it's a weird ending top-level domain address. I can just leave that blocked. If the page works just fine for why I'm there to begin with, no, then I know at least I'm not hurt by anything and I get what I want. It's kind of a promo for that tool for, you know, cause it's very similar to this attack here as far as prevention goes, just out of the box, raw prevention. But yeah, I just thought it was really interesting. Kind of want to highlight some, you know, easy techniques where someone's able to basically bypass some things and steal some things, that often isn't hot, except for Malwarebytes claims that they are able to pick up on this type of activity themselves. So yeah, I don't know what your thoughts were when you kind of saw these kind of things.
Well, it made me rethink a lot of my actions over previous years. you know, I aware of the skimmers, the online skimmers, but you generally, at least in, for me, I put them, you know, kind of out of sight, out of mind, because you don't really, this, and I think it's a good point of this article, you don't really know it's happening in right. most cases. Like a typical user is going to have to, you know, go and look at like the developer page to understand what tool they're using to process payments. And like, no one's going to do that. Right.
Right.
So it was interesting to me, really thinking about it, about, man, you know, starting the process, the potential. And I was, you know, again, I always kind of hark on numbers because I think like the stats really kind of, they scream at you. And, you know, just in the article, they talked, Malwarebytes talked about just over a couple of days having blocked 1,121 unique blocks for malicious skimmer sites. And that's just like a small statistic over a couple of days for Malwarebytes alone, right? You know, the web's huge. There's a lot of things out there. And I think about a lot of times where you know, anyone, you know, you shop online, you go to something and you tend to get, you know, unless you're on, you know, a major player like an Amazon or something, you're going to be redirected to a payment site, right? Typically somebody else is handling, there's another tool on a shop's website that's handling that, and you just don't know. So it's almost like, you know, I'm probably going to go look at some more developer pages going forward after reading this, just thinking about how easy it is to masquerade, you know?
Yeah, and I would say if it's a sketchy looking site, it would make sense to do that. But since they're compromised sites, you wouldn't really be tipped off to even look most of the time, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think almost never, right? A typical user is just never going to think about that. But I might have to add a few more moments of my.
So purchasing. I think what's genius about the online skimmer, though, like, you know, we're people that are aware of skimmer activity in general, they've seen it where there's like devices they put over credit cards, scanners at the gas station pump, or, you know, point of sales machines. And then someone has to like physically collect that, or maybe they can wirelessly extract that data at the things they skim, but they're only still in credit card or the data that's on a credit card, versus an online skimmer like this could pretty much steal any form data whatsoever. So they can actually get more data. So think about other forms that aren't just e-commerce that this would be effective for. And then the other thing, you know, kind of another plug for things I'm aware of, and I believe Capital One still offers it, but there are services out there when you do shop in e-commerce where you could spin up basically a unique token card for just that website. So even if something does get stolen, guess what? You don't have to like reburn your credit card and all your stuff. It's just that one token can get re-rolled. And also it's easy to say, well, we know where, if something was stolen, what site it was from. Like that's really good analytics to be able to say, oh gosh, it looks like my Amazon token was lifted. Well, that means something happened between you and Amazon or Amazon or whatever, you know, in that hypothetical. So it helps you also track down, like, where were you at risk? So it's really insightful for you. And so you don't have to be paranoid about everything. Right. So I think it's worth investigating those services for people that are aware. Like, I think Capital One has it. Apple might have some sort of thing like that. You know, there's other...
about everybody has it now, really. I think you
can
it's like a virtual card number. Right. And you could just plug that in one time use. You, and next time you go for it, it's a different number. Yeah.
So things like that, I think, are really good technologies, especially as, you know, this stuff's just going to grow. But yeah, look into those types of solutions, especially. So you don't have to be as paranoid as me and run NodeScript all the time and create the pain in trying to make sure your web pages load correctly.
Or go down my path and read all the developer pages to see if it's proper.
Right. Cool. What do you got for us next?
All right. So the next one I got, a little shorter, a little more on the nose, but I did think it was interesting, and I'm curious if it'll drive detailed conversation or not, but, it's from a blog post from Objective-C. Let me not butcher the word of the title, I'm just not going to go into it. So a cryptocurrency miner in the Mac App Store. So this article discusses and breaks down a crypto miner that was available in the App Store called Calendar 2. And it was by a company named Qubix, Q-B-I-X. So anyone could download it because it somehow found its way through and was signed off by Apple. So there's some breakdowns in the post that kind of shows how they identified it as a crypto miner. And it sits on a framework called Coinstash _XMR stack. Which is written in Swift, which was funny reading the article. There was some kind of fun with the article where they talked about how annoying Swift is to do analysis on. So the research identified its focus was on mining Monero. The miner app would also craft a nice little report that would send Mac home to the dev to show, you know, what the usage was, how much they were able to mine, things of that nature. And last but not least, the Calendar 2 app itself within its options actually tells you that it's going to use your spare CPU, stating that the calendar can unobtrusively generate cryptocurrency in the background. It says it right in the app, which is fun. So yeah, you know, this was just a little snippet one, something that kind of changed base a little bit just to talk about, you know, typically when I think of App Store stuff, you know, you tend to go and think of mobile. Mac handles it in a pretty similar fashion. But you would think apps like this, the you'd find these more on the Android side of the house where the gates are a little looser than the Apple side. And, you know, of course, things slip through, but this one seems so obvious, right? And then, you know, the other part, I don't know. I guess I'm stuck on the fact that it was signed off by Apple. And it's got me curious what else might be out there, right? As a growing Mac user myself, you know, what kind of things are hiding there, and, you know, what ways might we be able to go after looking for these things? It's a very entry, right through the door thought, but what do you think, Scott?
So yeah, this is interesting because, you know, my knowledge may be dated at this point, because I feel like I learned this stuff probably more than 5 years ago or 5 years or so. But basically I remember learning about or reading about how Apple validates the things they put on the store, right? So they do kind of have a automated kind of review of code at a static level. And I remember like other Apple related applications where they made it through, they're describing like, oh, this is how they did it because The code is actually written to assemble the real code later, so there was no triggers as far as the analysis. And that was like a really creative way to do it. Yeah, I learned about all these really creative ways they bypass all these like scanners and store, you know, restriction protections or whatever you want to call them. And then it's funny in here when they say they just ran strings initially looking at this. And out of strings, right, you can see miner manager, update miner, miner start, miner stop. So if people aren't familiar with strings, strings is a common tool. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head who created it. But basically what it does is you can run it against a binary or really any file, and anything that is typical ASCII type characters, you can change what kind of encoding you want. It will pull out what look like words that are just in plain text in whatever file. So it's really cool to run against binaries because sometimes you can catch some like notes or function calls or, you know, interesting anecdotes that might help you understand what it is. And in this case, they pulled out miner related things when it comes to statuses or, you know, what the miner's doing. And at first I was like, man, I would hope that Apple would do something like this. But then also I took a step back and was like, well, wait a second. Like, there are legitimate mining apps out there. So you could really go off miner key terms, right, to defend against this. So like, they can't scrutinize it too hard. And then not only that, like, maybe because they mentioned what the tool does in the background so that they call out the behavior, it doesn't violate anything, you know? So like, they might have found a way just in terms of services to bypass some controls that allow this out there. Then, you know, someone had to complain and be like, oh, this is, you know, kind of false advertising. It's really just a miner on the back end. I don't know, but, you know, it's really interesting. Like you said, you know, you get these, we know that there's a strong reputation for what apps get released to the Apple Store. And because we assume they're doing all these code things, and I think they are, obviously it's not a manual process by any means. You wouldn't be able to get apps published fast enough, especially if you had to do like a code review every time an app updated and things, that would be really tough. So yeah, that part was really interesting, and just kind of seeing this out there and kind of how it unfolds, you know, it just kind of, you know, just brings to top of mind, like, hey, you know, just because we have all these checks and balances of things, there's many ways to defeat things. And sometimes it's just a simple, something simple, right? And I would take this as a very simple way to get around some protections or get through. So, yeah.
Yes. Almost like the gap was seemingly just them being honest, because they were like, yeah, we're going to, this is a mind work.
Criminals will lie, right? So they're not lying. They're clearly not criminal. Right?
Yeah, no, clearly they're up to par. Yeah. What do you got next on the docket, Scott?
So this one's kind of a meaty one. And it's because it's from Huntress. They do really good detailed reports. This one is actually talking about APT32 or Ocean Lotus, as they've kind of been dubbed. But basically, they were recently discovered an intrusion with Vietnamese human rights defenders and their machines and their environment. And they were there for at least 4 years. So this is what I liked about this article, was it kind of just took me back of how we actually think of APTs, right? You know, this 4 year long intrusion, you know, pretty silent, stealthy, not aggressive activities while they kind of lay wait and collect information, versus we've been attributing a lot of Russian APTs is like get in and take things out because there's an act of war going on, right? Like there's more like need to do things immediately versus this is slightly different. Obviously, their target isn't so much of a threat where they need to neutralize anything. They're just like trying to gather information. But I love how they took multiple machines and the levels of persistence. And this is why when I talk threat hunting as well, why when people are like, well, what do you hunt for? And I kind of just distill it down to like, I really just care about persistence and execution. Not that I don't care about anything else, but it's like the two pieces that are the most common overlapping across adversaries and bad things. And you find consistency there. So like the more well-versed I get on those two verticals and MITRE, I think the better off I am overall as a defender, because I just seem to understand or be able to catch things more. And so like, for instance, one of the hosts did, they ran, you know, 4 scheduled tasks and 1 service. But like the first host, what was great in that diagram, it was 5 scheduled tasks and 4 registry run keys, you know, and these are things that we talk about all the time. Like, you know, and what I also think is really cool is, advanced adversaries might use these techniques slightly differently in how they do them. Like, for instance, some of the scheduled tasks, for instance, we're using COM object handling, right? Instead of having an actual path to an executable, they're actually calling COM objects. You really can't see what's going on. And then there's registry changes that allow certain COM objects to then call other things. And that's how they chain together their tags. So to be completely honest, it's advanced from that perspective when you talk about the technique of using a scheduled task, but it's still the same mechanism, right? Or, you know, one of the things I really liked was, you know, I don't know how many scheduled tasks usually are WScript running, right? WScript on a Windows machine is used around like VBA scripts, JavaScript, like just some sort of scripting language typically. And I don't look at that as a core function of the system. So if it being a scheduled task, that would stand out to me as like, why is WScript running on a scheduled task, for instance? And what's really cool is not only was WScript running, but you weren't able to tell what it exactly was running because it was actually targeting a data stream. So in the NTFS file system, you can actually create data streams off files, which is basically appending data to the end of a file that isn't seen as part of the file. But you can store things there. And they actually stored the VB script that WScript was running from that scheduled task as a data stream. So you'll see a file, you know, name plus the extension that's usually a colon, and then whatever it is that's the file inside the data stream listed next. So in this case, it was scheduler.ps1 colon log.txt. And so another example of that's kind of a not so advanced technique as far as using WScript in a scheduled task, but they're using a data stream as part of that process. And you can kind of see how maybe some of the advanced, you know, behaviors or knowledge plays into that a little more than what you might see from, say, a ransomware author. And then, you know, going further, what was really interesting too is, you know, while they were investigating, you know, these things, they basically were looking at things that were happening infrequently and running really small numbers, like, you know, the administrative commands that were being run, where that they were never exceeding or they rarely exceeded 3 commands in 10 minutes in a 10 minute period. And they, you know, never had more than a max of 12 being run on the system during any given day. You know, and when we talk about like, how do we stay silent and stealthy? It's those rare instances of those commands, you know, being run. And, you know, sometimes if you see certain commands like, you know, looking for, you know, who's logged in or looking at the trust systems or, you know, looking at groups on the account with or net discovery commands, sometimes a good tell when even investigating those is you see that command being run, and especially from a user, you don't expect to be running those type of administrative type commands because they're not an administrator themselves. And you look at just any adjacent activity that they're doing, it's like, oh, were they browsing the web a lot and then checking their email, and then all of a sudden a net command hit, and then they're back to checking their email and browsing, and then they open up, you know, some Microsoft Office thing. Like that in itself is kind of a, you know, peculiar because there's nothing that would drive that one moment of, I need to know what's going on with the system while I'm doing normal day-to-day tasks, right? So that's another thing that can make certain things stand out is what are the adjacent activities? You know, if they're opening a command prompt, PowerShell, doing a bunch of like administrative type processes, and then all of a sudden you see a net command, well, it might look like an intrusion, but it also could explain the behavior if they're administrators. So the context is really key there. And then the other thing I really love, and I harp on this all the time when I see it, because I really want people to care, is through all this work, it still launched a single character bat file, 1.bat, right? Like we talk about like, oh, they're so advanced, but they're so lazy, just like everybody. And it's so simple. And I feel like sometimes I'm starting to believe these single character things aren't actually attributed to people. I feel like it's attributed to the tools that make temporary files, that the tools themselves are written to be lazy because the person's writing those too. It's like, why make this crazy name? Just file's going to be temporary. It's going to exist for a second, and then I'm going to delete it after I'm done running, whatever. Maybe that's why too. I don't know, but it's incredibly interesting to me. But ultimately, I think it's a really good article to check out. I'm not going to walk through every single thing, but they do a good job breaking down every single scheduled task and what's like unique about it, or every single registry run key. I even talk about some of the COM objects being used and some of those chains. And even some of the administrative commands being run across the different hosts in the environment. So really, really cool. And cool that they're really focused on just persistence alone and how much detail is there. I wish when you look at full breach reports, it's like this for every part of it, right? Because this is the type of stuff that, as a threat hunter especially, definitely can, one, learn a lot from, but two, be able to operationalize much easier. So I've kind of stopped there because I kind of just threw a bunch out there. But yeah, what were your takes?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot, the single character file, you know, eventually we're going to talk about it enough and something's going to change, right? But it is funny. So, you know, as you're reading through this, as you're reading the article, so, you know, just rehashing from the top of the back of what you said, just echoing it, the article is really solid. The ability to come in here as a threat hunter and pick apart the pieces I want to go after, you know, how I might want to design hunts, how I might want to look at building detections, or really just dig into my environment for stuff, are really solid. But, you know, back, you know, walking back up that ladder a little bit, there was a lot of really creative mechanisms here. Like, there's clearly some advanced capabilities in what they were doing. You know, one of the things that I found interesting was how they would rotate between which scheduled task would do some of the enumeration or some of the data gathering. So they would pick, like you had mentioned, they'd set something to run, you know, maybe only 3 times in 10 minutes, but then something like looking for a whoami/priv to try to figure out what account is there and what privileges are there. So they maybe might take additional actions depending. They would rotate that through this different scheduled tasks on the same machine. I found that very interesting. Also, like, as you kind of go down, and there's even mention of breaking down this where steganography was leveraged, like in combination with some of these other techniques. And then continuing back up the ladder, you know, going back to the 30,000 foot view, they really kind of focused around, the article was talking about how it was a, you know, a humanitarian, Vietnamese human rights defender. So, you know, a nonprofit or a smaller organization. And then it kind of had a snippet. And this was the first thing I thought when I read this. These are pretty advanced techniques. Setting aside the single character.pat file, or the single character file.
The mechanisms are basic, but they use them in an advanced way. That's how I
They use them in an advanced way. Correct. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you for that correction. But yes. So they use them in an advanced way. But when you think about it, you know, I to me, all I wonder is, like, you know, the nonprofits of the world, the small organizations, that there's a lot of companies that have they play a critical role in larger critical things, where they might just do one thing, you know, and they are actively a target because of that, because of the way they tie into bigger groups, or maybe this data they have is that sensitive. And I just, like, thinking about an attack like this, like, I just can't imagine a lot of these targets are prepared to be able to do this, you know, like, be able to look in depth to these things. For me and you, we tend to stare at the stuff day in and day out, so we're pretty familiar with it. But smaller companies, smaller organizations, nonprofits with very restricted budgets, things like that, they're gonna have a hard time detecting these things. So that was another thought I had from this. But again, that's 30,000 foot view. I was walking back up the ladder.
No, the one other thing I failed to mention I thought was interesting, and I think they called out, was they did do a forced reboot of some of the systems, and they were saying maybe it's to make sure some of the configuration changes and things they did took hold or took place, maybe with the scheduled tasks or whatnot. But I was also curious, as a, you know, forcing a reboot, depending on what hooks you have, is that also to force, like, a net new login so that you have better chance to capture, you know, the right credentials if you had issues getting credentials and stuff for them?
Or password change, right? And maybe the creds have shifted because they've been sitting there for 4 years based on what those articles
have. Yeah, so, you know, and that's the other thing, right? Like, I'm assuming the reboot wasn't immediate. They didn't talk about the timing, but if the reboot happened after they've already had persistence for 2 or 3 years, like, what's the, you know, like there's got to be a reason, right? So that was also an interesting note. And then, you know, just to kind of call back on everything we've talked about, like, we talked about basic techniques used in advanced ways. I think everything we covered today kind of sums that up, right? When we talk about the skimmer, it's just a basic script call that's just pulling down JavaScript and running. That's just, you know, not really a hard technique. It's a one-liner, right, that does all that. And then you have, who was the other one, the one with WebDAV,
the Voldemort.
Yeah, like, you know, there's some, like, basic things with WebDAV, but by leveraging some of those things, you know, and then also using Google Sheets, right? Like, not really, like, advanced, right? Like, they're, like, basic, you know, capabilities that they were doing advanced things with. So I think that's really interesting. You kind of see the theme, even from, like, some of these are more criminal based. They're still doing really creative things, but they're using just basic techniques to get there. And I think that's what, you know, security practitioners like ourselves need to pick up on and highlight more. Because, yeah, if we focus on just the advancedness, sometimes we get caught in that weed where we get too specific and then things are always able to sidestep around our advanced way of detecting versus focusing more primitively and saying, well, you're going to have to go through this first. And, you know, we'll pick up on what's advanced and what's not later.
So. Yeah, very great. Very good point.
So, yeah, just one mention before we close out. You know, there will be another threat hunting workshop, the Hunting for Collection. That's going to be given with Lee Arcanal and Jorge Rodriguez. And, you know, there'll be like a whole, you know, when we talk about threat hunting, there is a whole intel side. So we'll be able to understand from the intel side, what is it that is involved in the collection, the hows and whys potentially, and then how to threat hunt for those. Because, you know, we do a lot of intel driven threat hunting. You'll be able to see that captured with that. And it's a live workshop that you can participate in October 2nd. of 2024 from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Definitely check it out. And if you don't have time to check it out, there will be some things captured so you can view that later, but you should definitely register so that it's easy to find those resources. So with that, I just want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 2nd, 2024. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.